ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Andrew Ford. This is The Music Show, and we're at the pits and on the picket lines for this episode.
We didn't want to strike. Nobody likes to strike. But we were left in a position with no alternative because of the situation we were placed in.
Get behind the banners and march down to Lenin.
There is no industrial reason why this strike should go on one day longer.
How long can this go on?
That I'm working in a coal mine, going down, 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 working in a coal mine. Whoop, about to flip.
The strike will go on till we win.
When workers are on strike, 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 strike.
The miners' strike gave the opportunity of pop music to actually stand up and do something other than just make records and make videos.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
What will become of this pit yard where men once trampled faces hard? So tired and weary, their shifts done, never having seen the sun.
There'll always be a happy hour for those with money, jobs and power.
They'll never realize the hurt they cause to men they treat like dirt.
Coal Not Dole. It's a song written by Kay Sutcliffe, the wife of a striking miner. Earlier this year, we saw the 40th anniversary of the start of the 1984-85 miners' strike in the United Kingdom. There was music there as part of it all along, songs addressing the big players such as the Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Arthur Scargill, who was the leader of the National Union of Mine Workers, as well as the striking miners themselves and their families, and also the strike breakers who crossed the picket lines, the so-called black legs. John Street is going to be our guide through this program. He's Emeritus Professor in the School of Politics, Philosophy, Language and Communication Studies at the University of East Anglia, and he's taught, researched and written widely on the history and politics of English protest music. He worked on a big research project on the history of English protest song, Our Subversive Voice, and we'll put a link to that resource on our website. Before we start on the music, we do need to set the scene. So, John, maybe you could take us back to March 1984. What happened?
This was a moment where there was a serious threat to the future of the mining industry and the National Union of Mine Workers, which had been a militant and quite forceful union, particularly in the early 70s, where it took on the Conservative government of Edward Heath, was decided to take action to prevent the closure of mines. They did so without a ballot, which was a controversial decision, but it meant that for at least those miners who went out on strike, this was a major challenge. They were taking on the Conservative government and, of course, the National Coal Board. And the strike was the last, as you say, almost 11 months, and was lost in the end.
Whereas in the 1970s, they had won. I mean, they effectively brought down the Heath government, didn't they, 10 years earlier?
Yeah.
So did they think they were in with a fighting chance this time?
I think they did. But, of course, what there had also happened as a result of the strike in the 70s, there's the coal board and the government had got wise to the strength of the miners and had built up reserves of coal. So it wasn't a good time in terms of leverage for the strike to take place. It was also a case of, we had now Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister, who was very determined to, as it were, get revenge for the defeat of the Conservative Party in the 1970s and took a very firm line and was intent on reducing the power of unions. So this was a real political battle as much as an industrial one.
And a personal one too, because it was very much Thatcher versus Arthur Scargill, the miners' leader, wasn't it? Why did he not want to hold a ballot?
I think I'm not entirely sure I would be able to give you his full reasoning, but I think what he was concerned with was that they wanted to act decisively and they wanted to act quickly, and the body taking the decision to go on strike was split. It wasn't a convincing majority that decided to go on strike, but it was enough to give Scargill the mandate he wanted. And I think it was a way of, as it were, showing his leadership strength and also for the miners to be able to act decisively. But it was a decision that perhaps cost quite considerably the miners, because there were splits within the union, and the Nottinghamshire miners formed a breakaway union. And there were villages in Nottinghamshire now, today, which are still divided between those who were working and those who were on strike. And the effects of the miners' strike are still with us in lots of ways.
Starting in March 1984, ending in March 1985, it was a long-running dispute during which more than 11,000 miners were arrested. Here's how ABC News reported the end of the strike.
The conclusion of a year-long dispute. Miners march back to work with their heads held high behind their union banners and with the accompaniment of a brass band. They've tasted bitter defeat, but they're not going to let it show. A year today, the British miners' strike started as it ended, with music.
So music was there throughout this industrial dispute. John Street, can you sum up for us, before we listen to some specific examples, what was the music for? Who's the music for?
One of the things that's important to have in your mind, I suppose, in thinking about the role of music in the miners' strike, was how divided the country became as a result. You know, it was an incredibly divisive time, I think matched only more recently by Brexit. And in those circumstances where there is division, I mean, you are looking for people to speak up for your side. And obviously the side without the voice of the government, without the voice of the coal board, without the voice of the media, was looking for alternative voices. And popular music provided that. It can do that in a number of ways. It can tell people about what's going on, but it can also create the basis for solidarity or in a sense of community. So I think it was a very important voice, a voice that also had emerged because popular music itself had become highly politicised in the aftermath of punk, but also with the effects of hip-hop, or the example of hip-hop. People were realising that music could be an important political voice. It had been in previous eras, of course, too, but this was another moment when music became, I think, highly political. And because of the ways the strike was organised, you know, musicians going in, saying, we understand your situation, we speak for you, even though they had no formal background or interest in mining traditionally, they were there to sort of offer the support of their fans, the support of other places in the country besides the mining villages and other places where the strike was taking place.
It was in the year of 84, shit really hit the fan, when Mac the Knife McGregor, Maggie Thatcher's hatchet man, said another 20 bits will have to close to meet the plan, and we'll dump another 20,000 miners. Daddy, were you with the first of the first? Did you tell the NCB to do its worst? Or did you save your lily liver, sell the union down the river, a scab, a blackleg, one forever cursed?
Of course, the tradition of music and protest music surrounding mining goes back well over 100 years before the 1984 miners' strike. And maybe we should talk about Daddy, What Did You Do in the Strike, which you and McColl and Peggy Seeger recorded, because this is absolutely in the tradition of mining protest songs. In fact, it references a song from the 19th century, The Blackleg Miner.
Peggy Seeger and Ewan McColl were amongst the most famous voices certainly in the folk protest movement. I mean, they, throughout the 60s, had produced songs, and they produced songs to order, as it were, as the political circumstances changed. Their song was a classic example of the kind of protest songs that the folk movement produced, the sort of challenging people to stand up for themselves or their community or to recognize their fellow workers.
What it means to be a miner.
Daddy, what did you do in the strike? Did you stand there with your mates and join the fight? Or did you show a yellow belly, spill your guts out on the telly? Did you let the bosses fill you full of shite?
Some didn't heed the strike call, for guts and brains they lack. They're the colour of a primrose, though their hearts and legs are black. And their noses are all brown with being up the rear of Mac. They're just a bunch of dirty blackleg miners.
Daddy, did you march at the head? Did you stand there on the picket line unfed? Or did you sell your mates to have a fortnight on the cost of rum? Or did you choose a two-week holiday instead?
They were the kind of folk musicians who put people on their spot. And that song you referred to, the Blackleg Miner, from the mid of the 19th century, was another example of people being told, don't scab on your union, stick with your union. That kind of spirit was part of what folk music or music more generally could do.
It's in the evening after dark when the blackleg miner creeps to work with his moleskin pants and dirty shirt. There goes the blackleg miner. Well, he grabs his duds and down he goes to hew the coal that lies below. There's not a woman in this town row will look at the blackleg miner.
I rub wet clay in the blackleg's face, and around the heaps I run a foot a race to catch the blackleg miner. I'm divin gang near the segal mine, across the way they stretch a line to catch the throat and break the spine of the dirty blackleg miner.
That's the British folk rock band Steel Eye Span singing a song from 1844, The Blackleg Miner. These sorts of songs not only warned of what would happen to strike breakers, they also served another historical function. Here's A.L. Lloyd, the English singer and folklorist. He delivered a talk on the ABC in 1970. It's part of a series called English Songs of Work, Play, Love. And he elaborates on the song and about this dual function.
Before long in the 19th century, certainly by the late 1820s, typical industrial ballads began to appear, as in which miners and other workers expressed their grievances very passionately often. As the masters became richer and the exploitation became more irksome, the workers had no newspapers to support their claim or to present their case. So quite often the songs are the best evidence we have of the temper of the men towards the conditions they were working in, and towards the masters who imposed those conditions. It's a remarkable song, comes from the northeastern coal fields, called The Blackleg Miner. And it recalls a time that lasted up until nearly the end of the 19th century, in fact, when strike breakers were likely to be hunted like hares on the moors and stripped of their clothes and their pit tools, thrown down disused shafts. And the song also mentions the dangerous practice of stretching a rope across the pitway so that as the non-union man came hurrying along with his tubs of coal, the rope would catch him by the throat and throw him backwards. The song has become a firm favorite in many parts of industrial England, not only in its native Durham. And here it is, Blackleg Miners.
It's early in the evening, just after dark, the blackleg miners creep to walk. With the moleskin trousers and the dirty shorts go the dirty blackleg miners.
Well, as we heard, the Blackleg Miner is quite a threatening song, and there was a fierceness too about the way that Ewan McColl delivered "Daddy, What Did You Do in the Strike," isn't there, John Street?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they were very forthright in the way they expressed their views, and you can hear other songs which are less sort of dogmatic or determined to take one side or the other, and that reminds you, of course, of the song that came from the 1930s that Billy Bragg records during the miner strike called "Which Side Are You On?" That was very much the spirit of the occasion. You know, you were either for the miners or you were for the government. And a song like "Daddy, What Did You Do in the Strike?" or "Which Side Are You On?" is to challenging people to take sides in a very divisive situation.
This government had an idea and Parliament made it law. Seems like it's illegal to fight for the union anymore. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Set off to join the picket lines, but together we cannot fail. We got stopped by police at the county line. They said, "Go home, boys, or you'll go into jail." And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
ABC journalist Tony Barrell interviewed Billy Bragg in 1985.
In the last 18 months in Great Britain, we've had the miners' strike, which gave the opportunity of pop music to actually stand up and do something other than just make records and make videos. I mean, I don't believe pop music changed the world, but I saw during the strike it could be used to channel people's ideas, to focus people's idealism. If we can build on that, then I think, yeah, we will be able to look back at the miners' strike and say that the sacrifices that were made, and they were great sacrifices, were worthwhile, because it wasn't the last-ditch stand. It was the flexing of a community muscle, and a major sort of stand was made there, and we may yet be able to look back on it and see it as the turning point in the fight against monetarism, Thatcherism, and all the things that we are opposed to.
Take much more than a union law to knock the fight out of a working man. And which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
We're going to leave the folky end of things behind for now and head into some poppier territory. John Street, you were telling us before, there was already a very political feel to a lot of pop music at the end of the 1970s and in the early 80s. Tell us about Test Department, because we're going to listen to Comrades in Arms, which is a surprising development for this band.
It is. Test Department, as a band, were known for their kind of highly industrial sound. You know, they would hit sort of metal objects with hammers and use that to form the backing for a striking miner speaking about their experiences of the mine.
Richborough Power Station, early in the strike, 25 pickets, 150 policemen. I want to talk to the captain and the crew. You can't come past here. Something about the ship and the attitude of the police, I had to try. I jumped up onto this wall and tried to make my way through the police lines. This policeman come running at me. I dived flat on the ground. I was dragged off to this van. A policeman showed up with a camera. They dragged me out of the van, dropped my feet, I put my arms in the air and slid straight to the floor. They picked me up. This young officer pulled me in. But he couldn't manage it. Another one pushed me back with the palm of his hand.
But then they produced this song, as you mentioned, Comrades in Arms, which effectively the band was not present. But what was a male voice choir, a very classic form, and particularly in the Welsh community, of how men got together to sing of their community and to, as it were, bond together. And this record, called Comrades in Arms, was, as it were, the sound of a male voice choir, but singing on behalf of the striking miners and for the striking miners and of the striking miners. It was a very different way of expressing the political mood of the time, and was drawing on a musical tradition that is very deeply embedded in mining communities, together with brass bands.
Listen, comrades in arms. Listen, give ear. Listen, comrades in arms. Dear to the Americans, a breathing, a song of praise, a song of praise. To see us only our achievements in our arms we raise, our arms we raise. Show this the finger that's around.
It's interesting that you mentioned the fact that male voice choirs in South Wales, in particular, were associated with mining communities, because like those brass bands that you also referred to, they were set up in the 19th century very often by the mine owners around the mines themselves, the idea being to provide recreation, I suppose, for miners who might otherwise be down the pub.
That's right. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, this is one of the things about the way popular culture works. It can, on the one hand, be used as a way of social control or management, and it can be subverted. And, you know, the slave songs and so forth are examples of where, you know, work songs become also the voices of rebellion and resistance.
Listen, comrades in
Back to brass bands for a moment. 10 years ago on the music show, we had the Grimethorpe Colliery Band in. They're a brass band whose story was told in that famous film Brassed Off, and their conductor, Dr. Robert Childs, explains how the closure of mines in the 1980s affected their communities and their musicians.
The Conservative government with Margaret Thatcher wanted to close all the collieries. She'd sort of piloted the programme in South Wales, where I was a few years earlier. All the South Wales mines were closed, and then systematically she closed all of the rest of the country's coal field, which left villages whose only occupations was working for the National Coal Board completely. Like, I mean, Grimethorpe at one time would have been 90% unemployed.
Yeah, got the whole village lost their jobs.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. So and the band was a big part of that, because when I came over here in 1981, everybody that played in the band was employed by the colliery.
Yes.
So obviously once the collieries close, then the musicians have to find jobs elsewhere, which is not easy when they've not had any experience of any other type of work for so many years.
The function of colliery bands has changed since the closure of the pits, but they're still around. Are they still central to their communities?
That's absolutely right. And we still, in the UK, we still have the annual Durham Miners Gala every year, where the brass bands and the trade union movement come together to celebrate their history and their present.
We're going to head now to the Durham Miners' Gala. They pronounce it Gala up there in the northeast of England. A large annual gathering associated very much with the coal mining heritage of the region and known colloquially as the Big Meeting. David Lumsden, who died at the beginning of this year, was an Australian composer whose career was almost exclusively in the United Kingdom. And in 1971, he took some of his students to the Big Meeting and they recorded on location. And the resulting piece was called Big Meeting. Here he is on the music show about being there and why it appealed to him as a subject for recording.
Studying sounds would appear to be very abstract, you know, but sounds are made by people. You can study people through their sounds. And there was going to be so many different areas of Durham in that day. The Old Elbert, where all the bands were going to pass and meet in front of the politicians. There was going to be the meeting at the race course with speeches and hymns there. There was going to be the fairground where everybody was going to be greatly happy and indulgent. Everything was going to be boarded up because there was a lot of drunkenness. The only places open would be the pubs. And then, of course, there would be the cathedral where there was a very big, very important service which would take place in the afternoon where the bands would be playing as very much a part of the... Not the establishment, no, that's wrong. A culture which had built up, which included all areas of the social strata in Durham. So my interest there was to explore these sounds with people making these circumstances. I didn't know what I was going to do with it afterwards. Mm. And in the centre of the recording, as it comes out, is this walk where I was going from the streets where everybody is kicking cans about and shouting out, up into a very quiet area approaching the cathedral and picking up a band which was playing on one side of the big square up there, Palace Green, and was going to start off marching round the corners of it and approaching the big entrance to the cathedral and moving into it. And what was extraordinary was the way the sound changed. There's this one verse which is played over and over and over again. And it's never the same. And the instrumentation is wildly different according to where the band is playing and where we're picking it up with the microphones. And the transformation as it moves into the cathedral doors itself is quite extraordinary. That was when I knew this wasn't just going to be documentation. This had to become a piece in its own right. To discover the piece that this would make, but it took many years to do that. This is something I don't talk about very much, but I think it was my first proper Buddhist piece.
That's a little of David Lumsden's Big Meeting. As John Street told us earlier, the gala's still going. I wonder how it sounds now. You're listening to The Music Show, and on this episode, we're looking at the 1984 miners' strike in the United Kingdom, and our guide to the varied music of the time is John Street. He's Emeritus Professor in the School of Politics, Philosophy, Language and Communication Studies at the University of East Anglia. John, we're going to hear a song now, well, if you can call it a song, from that mysterious group, The Enemy Within. It's in a similar vein to what Test Department did with the track Statement. They sampled the voice of a striking miner with industrial sounds. This track, which is just called Strike! Exclamation mark, samples speeches instead. And the band name itself refers to a phrase that Margaret Thatcher used to demean the efforts of the National Union of Mine Workers. She had just had a victory against the enemy without in the Falkland Islands, and now she was fighting the enemy within.
That's absolutely right, and is another indication of the way in which British society at the time was being divided, that the idea that we had enemies amongst our, you know, citizens was itself part of the sense of division that people felt as a result. And this record strike from the enemy within, as you say, you know, kind of parodying Mrs. Thatcher's idea, emerged from a somewhat unlikely venue, namely the Face magazine, which was a highly fashionable, very cool magazine, beautifully designed. But an office chat apparently gave rise to the thought, well, you know, given the miners have had no ballot, and there was another record that had just come out by Malcolm X, well, it was actually, you know, a cut-up of Malcolm X's speeches called No Sellout. And that idea of an equivalent for the miners was what inspired this record, The Strike, which uses Arthur Scargill's speeches and the sound of miners themselves, together with a kind of hip-hoppy style beat, to create, in this case, a charity record, which was another thing that was becoming very fashionable at the time. It was taken up by someone like Band-Aid. This became a surprisingly effective song, at least as far as the magazines like the NME were concerned, which made it single of the week. NME itself was almost more political than it was musical at the time. And here was a song that they got behind, again, in taking sides on the industrial dispute that was obsessing everyone at the time.
An unusual song, and there was a push to get it to number one.
There was, and it wasn't altogether effective, although it did appear in those highly dubious charts, that, you know, the so-called indie charts or non-record return top charts. So it did have the appearance of being rather more successful in sales terms than it actually probably was. But it certainly drew headlines, it drew a lot of attention, and was a very interesting intervention in the industrial dispute.
Yes, it is very hard, even in 1984, to imagine a 10-minute record of Arthur Scargill's speeches cut up and set to a kind of scratch rhythm getting to number one.
I think our taste might have been slightly more adventurous at times in those days, but not that adventurous.
Strike by the Enemy Within. Speaking of songs going to number one in the UK, it reminds me that at Christmas 1983, so just before the miners' strike, the a cappella vocal group The Flying Pickets had a number one with their version of the song Only You, and Margaret Thatcher effectively derailed their career because she named it as her favourite song.
Yeah, well, that kind of fate has befallen a number of bands, or at least, you know, I know, you know, David Cameron claiming he was a fan of The Smiths, and I think Gordon Brown said he listened to the Arctic Monkeys. All of these things were either entirely implausible and certainly unwelcome by many of the bands so named.
All I needed was the love you gave. All I needed for another day. And all I ever knew, only you.
Just John Street, you were talking a moment ago about charity records, and perhaps we should mention Bruce Springsteen here, because he toured the UK during the miners' strike and donated money to the cause.
Yes, he did. And he was performing in Newcastle, which was obviously an area in which, you know, there were some mining villages, and he invited miners' wives who were very important in the strike. They, you know, were very active as supporters and networks for the mining strike, invited them to attend one of his gigs, and in this case, it's St James's Park in Newcastle. So, yeah, it's interesting, that whole idea that these famous rock stars and so forth become involved in politics and become seen to represent a particular cause. Or it's something we've become very familiar with, you know, people like Bono and so forth doing it too. But you know, it should in a way take us by surprise, because these are highly individualistic creatures. They trade on their originality and their creativity. They tend to be reluctant to join their own union, the musicians' union or equivalent, but they are drawn into politics and act as political representatives in a sort of way, by speaking up for causes, for drawing people's attention to them, and being able to raise or distribute large sums of money on the back of their support and their willingness to stand up.
Well, I rode that ribbon highway. I saw above me the endless skyway. I saw below me the golden valley. Well, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled. I followed my footsteps through the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. And all around me, a voice was calling. It said this land was made. Well, this land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Well, this land was made.
Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band with Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. As you mentioned, John Street, it was in the news just recently that during that tour, Springsteen donated $20,000, gave a check to two miners' wives at his gig in Newcastle. Speaking of miners' wives, we ought to talk about Latin Quarter, because there's a song here that's really from the point of view of the women.
Latin Quarter are really interesting band, because unlike, say, someone like Test Department, who feel in order to express their political anger, they need to make an aggressive or loud noise, and you know, or punk as another example, they argued very much that the way to, as it were, reach the people who they wanted to hear about the causes and concerns they raised in their songs, they thought about making songs that were both attractive to hear, but, you know, had, as you might call it, hit potential, and at the same time to offer very serious thoughts and ideas within very eloquent lyrics. And you know, that song, The Men Below, is a very moving song, with the lines that, and who knows what we all owe to the boys in the dust, the men below. It's a very sensitive song about what was involved in mining, what it meant to be a miner. Something that perhaps got forgotten in the noise of the industrial dispute.
Album tour, album men, you're still picking at the shell. And you know you should be glad of the living, but it seems like a living hell. Sometimes on this paying stage you play so hard, but so much harder still. Where your hotel nights are the stuff of the dreams of the men below. Imagine having to fight to wait 2 miles down from the air and the light, and imagine having to plead that a job
Latin Quarter with their song The Men Below. I guess many of us might not have come across Latin Quarter before. I certainly hadn't. But Paul Weller is a familiar name in British rock music, singing in front of The Jam and with Style Council. John, tell us about the song Soul Deep that he did with Council Collective.
That's a very interesting intervention again that appears, like Billy Bragg singing Between the Wars, it appears on Top of the Pops, the show that in those days everyone who was interested in popular music would watch. And Paul Weller put together something called the Council Collective. And the song Soul Deep is, if you looked at the lyrics, you'd probably think, well, this is really a love song. Apart from that, you know, Soul Deep perhaps suggesting something going down into the mines, but beyond that, not much. But when you hear it being performed with a number of other stars from the British R&B scene, and from the US, in fact, you hear raps towards the end of the song, which are all about supporting the miners and all about treating people with respect. And it's probably one of the most political moments that Top of the Pops ever hosted, because there you were hearing very, very clearly political statements on behalf of the miners, which perhaps some would say were rather rarer parts of what the broadcast landscape provided.
Going on 10 months now, will it take another 10? I'm living on the red light with what some people said. Just where is the back end from the TUC? If we ain't united, they can only be me.
Think all those brave men, women and children alike. Build up unions so others might survive. In better conditions than abject misery. Not supporting the miners is to betray that legacy. Up north the temperature's rising. Down south she's whining, dining. The trade unions and the cash it costs to close them. It's better spent trying to keep them open. She makes a mockery of the unity. Guys fight between the church and humanity. Trying to feel the pain of those seeds burning. Now other things that we take for granted, like a pilot strike if we don't agree with the bosses that make those policies. They keep us down and keep us stuck, so we settle for less than number one.
Soul Deep. Paul Weller and Council Collective and hip-hop artists lending their voices to the cause of the miners' strike. John, all of the music we've heard so far in the programme has been in support of that cause. Were there any songs at the time that were in support of the pit closures, or for that matter, that were against the spirit of the strike?
Well, it's an interesting question. And I looked, and my colleagues who will be working with me on this protest project, we've been looking at, you know, at songs that don't just come from the left. Obviously, protest music is often understood to be sitting on the left, but there is protest music on the right. And there are examples, but they are very much fewer than are those that come from the left or left center. And so I haven't ever come across a song that speaks directly for the National Coal Board or Mrs. Thatcher in that particular context. But it's quite clear that in a lot of ways, others might well, by their silence, have been offering support, or by pursuing a traditional musical career, they were, as it were, choosing not to take sides or choosing not to voice their political opinions, whatever they might be. I mean, there certainly were, you know, musicians who were conservative voting or conservative sympathizing. So it's not that this view wasn't represented in the music industry in some way, but whether it ever got musical expression, I'm not sure of.
Yes. Well, I guess, you know, it comes back to which side are you on? And so you could argue that everything that we haven't talked about was on the other side.
Yes, you could do it that way. When we talk about musicians who take a political stance, one is aware that they take a risk when they do that, because particularly where a society is divided, you are, you know, risking 50% of your potential market. If you are seen to be so obviously on the other side, those who might be your fans might be put off by this. I think, you know, mostly people like Springsteen and so forth are quite comfortable with that predicament. But you can imagine that there are cases, and I heard musicians reporting that, you know, they have been warned that if they take a political stance, they are perhaps risking their commercial and creative future. So it's not, you know, a cost-free choice that they make when they engage with politics, that's for sure.
Yes, and I suspect that that's more true today than it was then. Which brings me to ask you whether you feel that there is a residue of this music in the music of the last 40 years. Did these songs and did this time change things permanently in any sense?
It's hard to say. I do think that that particular period, I mean, you know, from the 70s and the punk era onwards, made it more acceptable for mainstream popular musicians to engage with politics. And so I think there's been a continuation of that, and you see in music more opportunities or less risk attaching to certain kind of political views being expressed by musicians, and that musicians, perhaps as politicians, have become less and less trusted or valued. Musicians and other cultural representatives of various kinds have assumed greater presence, some of them even getting elected to office in the United States and elsewhere. Is a sign that, you know, things changed. I wouldn't want to attribute that all to the miner strike of 84, 85, but I think that did have an effect. But music, and as in all cultural life, goes in phases, and sometimes it becomes very explicitly political. You hear, you know, artists like Dave, the rapper in the UK, who is very explicitly political in the music he makes, and his music gets awarded prizes for exactly that. And there are others for whom, you know, politics has no relevance whatsoever.
And the other thing, I suppose, that we should say in terms of recent music is that songs about mining today are far more likely to be on the side of, you know, stopping it because of its environmental impacts.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in the history of the protest song, environmental issues, as with work-related and union-related issues, are a feature. Our project on the history of the protest song goes back to the 17th century, and one of the first songs we found is called The Pout's Complaint from 1619, which was a complaint about the fens in East Anglia.
Come, brethren of the water, and let us all assemble to treat upon this matter which makes us quake and tremble. For we shall rue if it be true that fens be undertaken, and where we feed in fen and reed, they'll feed both beef and bacon.
And then, of course, you know, 2016, Anonis does a song called 4 Degrees, which is about climate change and the risks to the planet of that. I think the environment and, yeah, what we do to it has an interesting other side to the debate over the miners' strike and what was implicated by that.
I wanna see this world, I wanna see it boil. I wanna see this world, I wanna see it boil. It's only 4 degrees, it's only 4 degrees. It's only 4 degrees, it's only.
That's Anoni and 4 Degrees, and grateful thanks to John Street for guiding us through the music of the miners' strike and this whole period of protest and division in the United Kingdom. Some of these divisions still exist. His research project, Our Subversive Voice, covers the history and politics of British protest song across the centuries, and it's been an invaluable resource to us. We'll link to it from our website. And also, if you go to the website, you'll find the details of all of the music that we've managed to cram into today's show. And on that note, also gratitude to the sound librarians here at the ABC who waded through many requests from us for mining songs. The music show is produced by Ellie Parnell and C. Benedict. Technical production this week from John Jacobs, and we're all on Gadigal land. And as soon as we started digging into this topic, we found a lot of great things in the archives, all manner of aspects of music and mining, songs about mining disasters, work songs, brass bands, films like Billy Elliot and Brassed Off, and lots of old folk songs. So we'll end with one of those. These songs, we only really know about these songs because of song collectors who, particularly in the early 20th century, but even in the mid-century, went around villages recording people and what they were singing. Here's Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger talking to the ABC's Peter Fry and Stan Correy about what this process of folk song collecting actually entailed. It's a gorgeous story.
We started collecting. Well, the point is, there were only about three of us in at the beginning of the revival. A.L. Lloyd, myself, and an Irishman called Seamus Ennis.
And Alan Lomax.
Lomax was the catalyst that drew us all together. He said, you know, it's a crazy situation. Here you have you here, and you have Lloyd there, and you have Seamus Ennis there. All of you have big body of songs that you've got in various ways. In my case, I'd inherited a fair number from my parents. And he said, you don't even know each other, and you're keeping these songs to yourselves. These songs should be given to the working class youth of the nation. And then they can find an identity. And this is really what we set out to do. We set out to create a folk movement so that people could identify with being English or being Scots or being Irish or Welsh or whatever.
This thing of keeping the songs to yourself is a feature of a number of field singers. We recorded in 1960 an old woman named Hannah Short up in near Newcastle in County Durham. And the people who lived in this area were people who were interested in folk songs. We asked them, have you collected in your area? And they said, yes, we've been around. We can't find anybody who sings the old songs. So we made a bet with them. We said, I bet we'll go within two blocks of where you live and we'll find somebody who sings an old song. And there was this old lady of about 90 who lived just about four doors down. And we went and we talked to her about her childhood. She's a little woman.
We said, do you know any old songs? She says, nah, honey, I never had time to sing. We said, well, what about when you were a child, the games you played? Did you play any song games? Nah, honey, I started work when I was eight. Never had time to play games. And we said, well, don't you remember anything? Well, she said, I remember at Christmas and New Year's Eve. The geysers would come, go in the town, you know, the miners from the village would come dressed all up and they'd sing songs and they'd do this little play. We said, what play was that? She said, well, one of them come up, he says, in comes I, old Dr. Brune, the best old doctor in the town. What marks you the best doctor by my travels? Where have you travelled? Europe, his rope, their rope, my rope, any rope. And she began to recite the whole text of a mumming play, you know, the seven champions of Christmas.
So then we said, well, what was your father? And she says, oh, he was a collier. And he said, well, do you not know any songs about colliers? So she said, no. Now, the fact that Ewan knew that there had been a song collected in this area called The Collier Laddie, The Bonnie Pit Laddie. She said, do you know a song called The Bonnie Pit Laddie? So she said, oh, the bonnie pit laddie, the canny pit laddie, the bonnie pit laddie for me, oh. He sits on his hunkers and yaps at the bunkers and brings white siller to me, oh. And she sang the whole thing.
Five verses of a six-line form that had previously been collected in this particular locality by Ritson, one of the very famous English collectors in the early 18th century.
So the people...
Really? Yeah.
The people we'd made this bet with were there. And they said, well, why didn't you sing this for us before when we came? She says, you never asked me, honey. And this is a feeling that an awful lot of field singers have, that the outside world is not interested, that the outside world is too sophisticated.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.